Hello, and welcome to the Popmatic Podcast. I'm Brian.
And I'm Crystal. We're librarians at Nashville Public Library.
This podcast is where you can find reviews and recommendations of the best books, movies, and music available for checkout from the Popular Materials Department of the Nashville Public Library.
You can also learn about library programs such as concerts, film screenings, book clubs, author talks, and book signings.
It's July, but I still have that bug in my throat. By the time you hear this, I'll probably have been to a doctor. Otherwise, we're back at full strength. On this month's show, Crystal and I feature music of the neo-prog quintet Elbow and the teen idol turned avant-gardist Scott Walker. Amanda reveals the literary delights of The Song Is You by Arthur Phillips, and Julie critiques the newest from Wally Lamb, The Hour I First Believed. Filmic duo Bill and Clint round things out with notices for Vernon, Florida and Tulane Blacktop.
Can't believe I didn't know about this band, which I am now totally obsessed with. The five members of English band Elbow came together at college in the early 90s. Their first studio record was released in 2001. The Mercury Prize winning The Seldom Seen Kid, released last year, was their fourth full-length album and the album I'm about to gush over. Elbow creates songs that are sonically sophisticated yet accessible and take their time to build, especially on the album opener, Starlings. Guy Harvey's lyrics are at times deceptively simple, but when you put the words with the music and his amazing vocal delivery, all thoughts of cliché are removed. Let's listen to a clip from the second cut on the album. It's called The Bones of You, and it's about hearing a song that brings back a vivid memory of lost love.
And I'm 5 years ago, and 3,000 miles away.
The Seldom Seen Kid was brilliantly produced by their keyboardist, Craig Potter. It was inspired in part by the loss of their friend, Brian Glancy, the Seldom Seen Kid referred to in the album title. He was a singer-songwriter in Manchester. The closing song on the album is a gorgeous musical tribute to Glancy called Friend of Ours. Listen to this album from beginning to end, loudly, to really appreciate the quiet moments.
No singer has had a career like Scott Walker. Emerging as a pop superstar in the late 60s, as lead singer of the Walker Brothers, Scott gave it all away. He dissolved the band and began releasing progressively more melodically sparse and lyrically abstract solo records. In the history of popular music, has there been an artist whose critical acclaim is indirectly proportional to their popular accessibility? Walker's most recent album, The Drift, remains broodingly intense, even if we can't figure out what he's singing about. He's a master of setting a mood, if you consider Shattered Agony a mood.
That's a swanky suit, in a pulp like no other. I'm looking for a good cowboy.
That's from the track Caustics Are, and I have no idea what it means. Crystal told me it was something George W. Bush once said to Jacques Chirac during a press conference. Now into his 60s, Walker's once impeccable baritone is a bit huskier, but with his precise diction and unrivaled expressiveness, he remains head and shoulders above other singers. Yet with words few and meanings oblique, his is an aesthetic of denial. Walker could croon you to tears if he so chooses. He chooses not. Instead, he gives us donkey noises.
Sonny boy, such a sunny boy, there's a song in the air.
Supposedly that one, from the song Jolson and Jones, is a reference to 1930s musical star Alan Jones and his novelty hit Donkey Serenade. The lines about the donkey and the cowboy worked perfectly for me, just the way they are, and don't have to reference anything other than themselves. My bewilderment is exhilarating. The drift is a cloud in an abyss which spits chunks of music like hailstones. It is the moment when a normal dream becomes a nightmare.
Hello again. This is Julie, back with another book review. Amanda's here too, but I can't get her attention, so I'm going first. This month, I'm talking about a new novel by Wally Lamb. Lamb usually takes years to complete his somewhat lengthy novels, but they're always worth the wait. In this case, 10 years. The Hour I First Believed came out in 2008, and I delved into it as an audiobook. I always enjoy talented reader George Guidall, and I found the book to be thought-provoking and rich as it explores three complex topics. One, the aftermath of the 1999 Columbine High School shootings. Two, what real people do when their marriage is in crisis. And three, a middle-aged man's effort to understand his family history and grow into a better human being. The story is told by Calum Quirk, a high school teacher in his 40s with deep family roots in Connecticut. As in his previous novels, She's Come Undone and I Know This Much Is True, the author has masterfully created a believable, flawed protagonist who elicits a range of emotions from the reader, from empathy to repulsion, as he navigates the devastating aftermath of the Columbine tragedy and its debilitating effect on his wife, Maureen, a school nurse who was present during the rampage. When they leave Colorado and move back to his family farm in Connecticut, Calum and the traumatized Maureen face an uphill battle as they try to return to normal. In the second half of the book, when you might be wondering how much more their marriage can withstand, a new tragedy strikes. Lamb skillfully weaves in ancient mythology and old family letters into this very contemporary story, told with compassion and realism, as his characters struggle with the difficult challenges of forgiveness, healing, and faith that come with being fully human. And now let's see what Amanda has to tell us. Amanda? Hey, are you there?
Oh, what? Sorry, I was just listening to my iPod. Hey, this is Amanda, back in book world again after taking a brief sojourn to music land. I know it's confusing when I jump back and forth like that, so to try and make things easier, I thought this month I'd review a book about music. See what I did there? Nice transition, huh? So anyway, our main character Julian, from The Song Is You by Arthur Phillips, is a music aficionado who always seems to be listening to his iPod. He has 8,146 songs at his disposal, ready for any occasion. One night, he's out walking in New York and happens to hear a new band with an inspiring young Irish singer. The girl is magnetic, and Julian is immediately drawn to her and her music. Most of the book tells the story of how their lives intersect, or, you know, don't. In the past, I've read quite a few books by musicians, or about music in general, and none of them have ever quite done what I've wanted them to do. I can't really describe what I'm looking for, being a musician myself, but this one has come the closest of any of them. Here's a brief sample of what I mean. A piece of music's conquest of you is not likely to occur the first time you hear it, though it is possible that the aptly named hook might barb your ear on its first pass. More commonly, the assailant is slightly familiar and has leveraged that familiarity to gain access to the crisscrossed wiring of your interior life. And then there is a possession, a mutual possession. For just as you take the song as part of you and your history, it is claiming dominion for itself, planting fluttering eighth notes in your heart. Pretty good, right? There are still a few things about the book that bug me, don't get me wrong, but you're just gonna have to read it for yourself and see what you think. I won't spoil it for you.
Hi, this is Bill with a movie review. Someone asked the Southern Gothic writer Flannery O'Connor, why do you write such weird and bizarre characters? Miss O'Connor replied, "Because in the South, we still know what a freak looks like." Which brings us to the movie I want to recommend to you. It's Errol Morris's 1982 documentary, Vernon, Florida. Errol Morris stated, "When I made Vernon, Florida, I looked at it as a failure. In part, I had gone down to make one kind of film and ended up making something completely different." The movie Errol Morris wanted to make was Nub City. This movie was to be about insurance fraud in Vernon, Florida. You see, some of the good town folk were blowing their limbs off with shotguns to collect insurance payments. However, after Errol Morris got down to Vernon, Florida, the participants were unwilling to talk, and Morris's life was threatened. So, Nub City became Vernon, Florida. In this film, he simply films some of the local population of the town. The camera never moves, there is no plot, and the movie itself is only 56 minutes long. Among the local color you get to meet is a man who is obsessed with wild turkey hunting, a cop who sits in his patrol car all day because he has no crime, a minister in one of his sermons is obsessed with the word therefore, and a man who has his own private animal collection who thinks his turtle is a gopher. I still remember back in 1982 when they showed this movie on PBS. The next day everyone was saying, "Did you see that movie on PBS last night?" Unlike other Errol Morris documentaries, Gates of Heaven, The Thin Blue Line, and The Fog of War, Vernon, Florida is not as well known. But it's certainly worth checking out. And after watching the movie, if you're interested in learning more, Oxford American Magazine did a great article in their April 2002 issue. The only thing left to say is, welcome to Vernon, Florida.
This is Clint back in Popmatic Land after playing hooky from last month's podcast to go fishing. I soon learned that I'm not much of an angler, so here I am back to what I somewhat know best, the podcast movie review. Wanting to keep a summer theme for my review, and other than fishing, which there's really no good movies about, the next best thing I could think of to bring that summer spirit is the road trip. If cinema plus the road trip was an actual equation, then I'm pretty certain that the answer would be Monty Hellman's Two-Lane Blacktop. Made in 1971, Two-Lane Blacktop was supposed to be the movie of the year, but turned out to be a total flop since everyone was expecting Easy Rider, the sequel. Hellman's minimalist masterpiece only holds a superficial resemblance to Dennis Hopper's film. As Hopper portrayed his hippie motorcyclists as counterculture superheroes whose freedom can only lead to their martyrdom, Hellman's protagonists are bound by the freedom of their closed-off worlds with an almost monastic integrity that has no sacrificial release. What little plot Two-Lane Blacktop has revolves around two drag racers played by folk singer James Taylor as the driver and Beach Boy Dennis Wilson as the mechanic. They roam the country on their way east, drag racing their primer gray 55 Chevy Hot Rod, with the only chit-chat between the two being about carburetors, headers, and transmissions. They speak about such topics in a way that most people talk about the weather. Their insular world is finally breached, but only so slightly, by a young free spirit played by Laurie Bird, who is credited in this film of nameless characters as the girl. She tries her best to work her way into their world, but is only exasperated by the lack of notice and the self-absorption of the two gearheads. Our racers soon find their next score in the form of a gentleman that they coined GTO because of the yellow 1970 Pontiac muscle car that he drives. GTO is played with resounding verve by veteran character actor Warren Oates. The boys challenge him to a race to Washington, D.C., with the winner getting the other's pink slip, racing slang for the car title. The race begins with a gusto, but soon peters out as all parties seem to lose interest and retreat back into the world of their own creation. As the movie progresses to its end, it soon makes a turn into the mildly surreal, and finally ends in what director and fellow Two-Lane Blacktop obsessive Richard Linklater calls the most purely cinematic ending in film history. Even though Two-Lane Blacktop is stacked with youth, this is Warren Oates' film. GTO, with his devilish smile and V-neck cashmere sweaters, drives the land picking up hitchhikers, as that seems the only way he can keep company. He spins yarns about himself that change from person to person, but not in a way that ever seems underhanded. I think the best way to describe the character is a con man with no con. It is much to Oates' credit that the character comes off as hilarious and tragic at the same time. On the cinematic landscape, I cannot think of any other movie quite like Two-Lane Blacktop. Going on 40 years now, it still seems fresh and modern, unlike most films of that time. I would say that probably 2 days out of the week, I would call it the greatest movie ever made. Now back to Bill with a very important announcement.
For those of you that have supported our Movies at Maine film series on the second Thursday of the month, we thank you. Beginning in July, Movies at Maine will move to the second Saturday of the month, beginning at 2 p.m. The screenings will take place in the Maine Library Auditorium. On Saturday, July 11th, our Sci-Fi Summer Film Festival continues with The Incredible Shrinking Man, directed by the late Jack Arnold. His daughter, producer Susan Arnold, has provided a special audio introduction recording especially for the screening. Hope to see you there.
You've been listening to Nashville Public Library's Pop-Matic podcast. For more information, please visit www.library.nashville.org.
That's on the interwebs.
I'm looking for a good cowboy.